what Senator Cantwell is asking the EPA to do is put their shoulder behind a science-based decision.
A U.S. senator from Washington State takes a stand on the Pebble Mine. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, low enrollment may force a Kenai Peninsula school to close.
It appears that our people are just leaving. These are children that were in seats last year at the end of the school year, and now they're not here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The battle over the Pebble Mine in southwest Alaska is extending to the lower 48. This week, U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington State sent a letter to the head of the EPA urging her to, if necessary, consider using the Clean Water Act to stop the development of the mine. If the EPA uses its veto power over the mine before the permitting stage, it would be a first for the federal agency. KDLG's Daisha Eaton reports.
In the letter to EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, Washington State Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell expressed support of the EPA's decision to conduct a thorough scientific analysis of the effect that a large-scale development project would have on the Bristol Bay watershed, adding that Bristol Bay salmon populations are economic linchpins for commercial fishermen, not just in Alaska, but also in Washington State. In her letter, Cantwell writes, "Should scientists determine that pollution from a large-scale development in the Bristol Bay watershed could have unacceptable adverse impacts on water quality and the fish stocks that depend on it, I would support efforts to prohibit or appropriately restrict such activities, including the utilization of Section 404C of the Clean Water Act. 404C gives the EPA the power to veto permits required to develop the mine if it's determined that the impacts would be too damaging to waterways. If developed, the Pebble Mine could be the largest open-pit mine in North America. The claim area spans 150 square miles near Lake Iliamna. It's estimated that more than 80 billion pounds of copper and more than 100 million ounces of gold could be extracted from the site, which is being explored by UK-based Anglo-American and Canadian-based Northern Dynasty. Supporters of the mine argue it would create jobs. Opponents argue the mine could leach toxic waste into the watershed, wrecking commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing for generations to come. Barney Warren is a commercial fisherman from Washington State who's fished for sockeye in Bristol Bay for nearly four decades. He says Senator Cantwell's letter is a step in the right direction, and he hopes more politicians will start speaking out to protect Bristol Bay.
I think it's great that she's willing to take a stance on this. I want them to study it, and I don't believe that they can actually protect the watershed like they claim that they can. I just see this as the beginning of a slow-moving catastrophe. You know, my conclusion is that it's very unlikely to be compatible with our fishery, but I've got faith that the EPA can look this over, too, and come up with an honest answer.
There have been several attempts to stop or slow down the development of the Pebble deposit. Those attempts included a statewide voter initiative that was rejected and the recent request by several tribal and fishing entities to have the EPA step in and preemptively use its veto authority under the Clean Water Act. Last month, the Alaska Supreme Court approved a ballot initiative in the Lake and Peninsula Borough that could restrict permitting of any large project that would harm salmon runs. In a press release, Senator Cantwell says she's been contacted by thousands of Washington State residents recently, expressing concern about the potentially harmful long-term impacts of the mine on Washington State businesses. It's estimated that in 2008, Bristol Bay yielded over $113 million in total value for Washington State commercial fisheries, while recreational salmon fisheries yielded an additional $75 million. And it's not just fishing that brings home the money to Washington. It's also processing. Nearly all the major seafood companies that process salmon in Bristol Bay have a footprint in Washington. Nancy Blakey is co-owner of Snowback Products, which has a plant in Dillingham. She says if something went wrong with the mine, it would inevitably impact her business.
You can't push rewind. That mine goes in. There's no rewind when things go wrong. I think that what Senator Cantwell is asking the EPA to do is, if science backs up that it would heavily impact the Nishigak watershed, then she's asking the EPA to put their shoulder behind the Clean Water Act, CWA 404C, which is just a science-based decision.
Cantwell is sure to face opposition on the Pebble Mine issue from Alaska Republican Senator Don Young, who introduced a bill earlier this year that would restrict the EPA's reach, stripping the agency of its 404C veto authority. Many well-known national environmental and conservation groups, including the Sierra Club and Trout Unlimited, oppose the development of the Pebble deposit, and politicians throughout Alaska have been taking sides. But Senator Cantwell is the first politician from outside Alaska to take a stance on the issue. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A fuel spill in Nome Saturday morning leaked up to 1,000 gallons of diesel fuel into the ocean near the harbor. Lorelei Kanin of Station KNOM in Nome has the story.
The vessel that hit the rocks near the Nome Harbor and spilled up to 1,000 gallons of diesel fuel belongs to Alaska Logistics, one of the main shippers to Western Alaska. 10-year owner and general manager for Alaska Logistics, Alan Long, says the Kaktovik 2 was trying to move a barge off the beach when one of the tow wires got caught in the propeller, which left the tug at the mercy of the ocean. And Friday night, when the vessel could not operate, there were up to 5-foot waves. The Kaktovik 2 ended up hitting some rocks, and Long says 600 to 700 gallons of fuel spilled into the ocean. Saturday, booms were put in place around the vessel in key locations, and oil-absorbent material was placed on the beaches. DEC's State On-Scene Coordinator for Spill Response, Ashley Anderson, says one responder from the DEC is on scene, working with U.S. Coast Guard, Harbormaster Joy Baker, and Alaska Logistics to develop a towing plan. Their plan is to eventually move the vessel onto a barge. Anderson says because the Kaktovik 2 has a large hole, they do expect further release when they remove the vessel from the water.
The responder will stay on scene and make sure that that is contained and done in a manner that is safe and protects the harbor.
And Alaska Logistics General Manager Alan Long says the Coast Guard first has a plan to move the Kaktovik 2 to the dock in Nome to inspect the vessel.
There's going to be a little bit of a process, but we hope to, by tomorrow, get it craned out on the dock, and then hopefully the next day get it craned onto a barge and take it out of get it back to Seattle.
The DEC's local responder has not been able to do a full onshore assessment due to the high waves, but plans to head out this afternoon to see how things look near Snake River and the entry to the harbor in Nome. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kanin.
Another air traffic controller who says he worked with Korean Flight 085 that was diverted to Whitehorse on September 11, 2001, has come forward with additional details of the day's events. APRN reported Friday that retired air traffic controller Rick Wilder says the pilot was ordered to squawk that he had hijackers on board. Dave Connett worked as an air traffic controller in Anchorage for 15 years and was also in the tower and worked the flight that was suspected of being hijacked that day. Connett contends he was the first that ordered that he was the one that first ordered the pilot to squawk the 7500 hijack code. Connett says it was because of a message the pilot had sent to his own company, Korean Airlines.
He, as I understood it, sent a company message saying that he was hijacked, and that got to us. So we were expecting a hijacked aircraft when we finally did radar identify him and talk to him.
Connett says he asked the pilot to verify squawking 7500, and he says the pilot said disregard. Then Connett's area manager directed Connett to instruct the pilot to squawk the hijack code. Connett says he gave the order, and the pilot did not argue. He complied.
So at that point, we figured, well, he must be getting hijacked. And so at that, I was given instructions that he could not go to Anchorage. So I tried to turn him away from Anchorage, and he was very resistant. It took several transmissions to convince him that he could not and he was not going to go to Anchorage.
Connett says he's also a pilot and had never before given such a command. He says the order to tell the plane to squawk 7500 .00, meaning it had been hijacked, surprised him. But he looked later, and it was in the FAA manual. He says when those regulations were written, it was presumed that a hijacker would be someone bursting into a cockpit with a weapon.
And one of those would be that a scenario that if a hijacker is standing in the cockpit and he's telling the pilot what to do, and the controller tells him to do something, like Squawk 7500, the hijacker normally wouldn't know what that means. So if the pilot did it, it would confirm that he is being hijacked. But if he wasn't being hijacked, it's incumbent upon the pilot to say, to know the code and say, no, I'm not being hijacked.
The pilot's lack of protest about the code added to the suspicion that the Korean jet had been hijacked. This confusion is what then NORAD commander, now Air Force General Norton Schwartz, outlined when he spoke to reporters in the days after the event. Schwartz said if controllers asked pilots to confirm that they were squawking that code, the correct response would be negative, negative, I am not that code.
Apparently what occurred was that the crew either misconstrued what was said, or perhaps what was said wasn't exactly, according to the textbook, and they understood that they should squawk that code.
Conant says he wanted to clarify some of the day's events and affirm that the jet had been sent to Whitehorse because of concerns it was in fact a hijacked plane, and it was determined that sending it to Whitehorse endangered less lives than Anchorage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look at what could be in store for this winter in Alaska.
Think of it as taking some loaded dice into a casino. You know, you won't win every time, but you'll win more often than you should.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Legislators today revived what once was a regular step in preparing for upcoming legislative sessions. The House Judiciary Committee discussed recent court cases that might require action during the session. Anchorage Democrat Max Grunberg said the annual meetings were routine when he was first elected to the House in the 1980s.
This is the first meeting in 10 years of this committee dealing with this report. And so what we're doing today is setting the precedent, I hope, the way the House Judiciary Committee and maybe the Senate Judiciary Committee, too, will look at these reports.
The committee considered eight cases chosen by legislative attorneys and the Department of Law. Of those, only two were referred for further consideration next year. The Labor and Commerce Committee will look at statutory changes to address a court decision on who is liable for workers' compensation claims. Legislative Attorney Dennis Bailey said in its decision, the court pointed out potential consequences the legislature did not expect when the law was written.
If a subcontractor doesn't provide workers' comp coverage, then the contractor's liable. And if the contractor doesn't provide coverage, the project owner is liable.
Bailey said the court pointed to a property owner hiring a snowplow contractor who doesn't insure his subcontractors for injuries. The property or homeowner could be held responsible for a worker's claims. The Health and Social Services Committee will take up a frequent problem for lawmakers, certificates of need. They are now required to prevent unnecessary competition among medical services and were the subject of a recent court case. Anchorage Republican Bob Lynn said he wants to eliminate certificates of need altogether.
The whole thing's rather confusing. Your language can be. Can anybody explain to me if a certificate of need is actually a more politically correct way of saying certificate of monopoly?
Among other cases the committee discussed but didn't act on were those involving distribution of pornography, ballot initiatives under the election laws, and predator control. Work on the ice-breaking ferry Susitna is nearing completion, and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough officials are scrambling to find a place to put the vessel when it arrives. The Borough Assembly is considering a number of ideas as to how to cope with the financial obligations of storing the ferry over winter. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The ferry project has been a priority of the Matanuska-Susitna Borough administration for years. The keel was laid in August of 2006 at Alaska Ship and Dry Dock in Ketchikan. Now the completed vessel will be ready for delivery sometime between now and the end of the year, according to borough manager John Moosey. But the borough has not built any landings for the ship yet on either side of Knik Arm, so the problem is what to do with the ferry when it arrives. Estimates are that it will cost about $1 million a year to dry dock the Susitna.
We have been working hard to find another spot in the Ketchikan port area that will be less costly to us. We think probably by $250,000 cheaper just annually to hold it there.
At a meeting 2 weeks ago, the borough assembly considered how the administration could reduce the operating costs of storing the Susitna while filling its obligations to the Federal Transit Administration and the Office of Naval Research. Both federal agencies are involved with the one-of-a-kind catamaran, dubbed an expeditionary or e-craft. Moosey says it's doubtful now if the ferry will be making any money for the borough anytime soon.
And looking at the numbers, looking at the time it's going to take to get the thing up, developing a good customer base, it's going to be a while. And I think short term, it definitely won't be able to meet its financial obligation short term. I think longer term, if the customer base is developed, it can.
The borough assembly has directed Moosey to gather more information on 8 specific areas. Obviously, seeking additional grants for ferry landings is one of them. Moosey says the borough has $7 million earmarked for a landing on the borough side. The snag has always been an anchorage landing spot. The borough and the municipality have never come to agreement on exactly where the Susitna could safely unload its cars and passengers in the traffic-congested Port of Anchorage area. Steve Rebuffo is deputy director of the Port of Anchorage.
There never was in any of the planning for the port expansion an accommodation made for the ferry. In fact, the port expansion plans were finished long before the Matsu Borough had an opportunity to get this vessel at some point, which is why, after the fact, the port put up $150,000 to sit down with the borough to try and find a place to make the ferry fit at the port.
Rebuffo says the borough, after months of talks, decided not to land the boat at the port. The immediate problem is where to put the ship until its ferry runs start. The borough is currently working on lease agreements with private companies, Moosey says.
Timing is also of the issue. When do they need to use the boat, and does it interfere with our use of ferry service? And that's something we're kind of working out. I don't have anybody who wants the ship today.
One other option discussed at the August meeting, incorporating the ferry into the state's Alaska Marine Highway System. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Kenai Peninsula Borough School District has lower enrollment than it anticipated, and the borough may have to close one school. The superintendent briefed the borough assembly on the issue last night. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
Superintendent Steve Atwater says that the district does not have enough students in seats. That holds true through the upcoming annual count of students. It will mean not as much funding from the state of Alaska as they projected. They projected having around 9,000 students, but early estimates show more than 200 students less than that. Of several schools with the most dramatic issue is low numbers at Cooper Landing School.
Cooper Landing School currently is at 9 students. And in case you don't know, you need 10 to get funded by the state. And so we're at a situation there at Cooper Landing where we need another student to be enrolled during the count period. The count period is in October. And if that doesn't happen, the state will not fund the school. The children will receive funding, but the building itself won't get funded. And so I would be faced with a decision to recommend to the board probably to close the school at that point. The school board, if it then take action on that, would occur in November.
Atwater says it's especially concerning because they expected to see 13 students there this year instead of 9.
It appears that our people are just leaving. These are children that were in seats last year at the end of the school year, and now they're not here. And so you guys probably have a better grip on where people are going, but it appears that families are leaving the borough.
Atwater says that overall, school enrollment is looking flat, but that in the long term, it seems that the population of the borough is aging and could indicate future declines in enrollment. Atwater says the borough should be proud, though, of the students themselves, whose annual standards-based assessment test scores have been steadily increasing. He says they look good compared with scores from other districts in Alaska. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Memorial services for a Juneau man killed last week in an underground accident at Kensington Gold Mine are tomorrow at 3 p.m. at the Juneau Christian Center. 30-year-old Joe Tagaban died Wednesday while working at the 1,260-foot level underground. It was the first fatality since the mine opened in June 2010. Rock from an underground blast struck Tagaban, according to a preliminary report from the Mine Safety and Health Administration. The report says he had been working near a previously drilled hole that had not been plugged. The blast sent a concussion of rock through the hole, striking him. That section of the mine remains closed while the investigation is underway, according to MSHA spokeswoman Amy Louvier.
That closure order covers the affected area of the mine where the accident occurred. However, it also prevents the mine operator from conducting any blasting in the mine until we've determined it's safe to do so.
MSHA and Mine Owners Corps Alaska are investigating the accident. Investigators from the MSHA Boise office have been at the mine since last week to gather evidence from the scene, conduct interviews, and piece together an accident timeline. Louvier says the investigation could take a few weeks or even months. Officials with a Canadian-based mining company say they found promising ore deposits near Toke. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Vancouver, BC-based Heatherdale Resources began exploratory drilling last month in an area about 36 miles west of Toke. Company officials say the on-the-ground work, along with aerial surveying, has turned up evidence of profitable deposits of zinc, gold, silver, and copper in the area. Sean Thompson, an investment advisor with Heatherdale's parent company, says the exploration indicates a strong potential they'll be finding new deposits in the Delta Project area. Thompson says Heatherdale's exploration around Toke is in its early stages and is part of the company's efforts to prospect elsewhere around Alaska now that advanced exploration work at Heatherdale's main prospect in the state, the Niblack Project in southeast near Ketchikan, has shown sizable concentrations of the same metals as the Delta Project.
Niblack's our flagship right now. We're hoping, obviously, depending on the drilling at Delta, you know, if that could become a working project as well, great.
Work at Niblack is much farther along than the Delta project. Alaska Miners Association Executive Director Steve Burrell says exploration has been going on in the area west of Toke for decades.
Heatherdale is the most recent company to be exploring in that area. It's been known for 30 or 40 years, there are all the indications that there should be a major base metal ore deposit there, zinc in particular.
State Department of Natural Resources officials say the Delta Project, along with Heatherdale's Niblack prospects, are two of at least five large mining exploration projects now underway in Alaska. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The National Weather Service confirms that La Niña has reemerged in the Pacific Ocean, and it's anticipated that it will gradually strengthen and continue into winter. A strong La Niña could impact weather patterns in Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The reemergence of a La Niña has prompted forecasters with NOAA's Climate Prediction Center to upgrade last month's La Niña watch to a La Niña advisory. Mike Halpert is the deputy director of the Climate Prediction Center. He says La Nina winters often result in drier than normal conditions across the southern tier of the United States, with wetter than normal conditions across the Pacific Northwest. Halbert is quick to point out that a La Nina should be seen as just a contributing factor to a particular weather pattern.
Think of it as taking some loaded dice into a casino. You know, you won't win every time, but you'll win more often than you should. And really, that's what La Nina does. It favors wetter-than-average conditions during the winter in the Pacific Northwest, favors colder-than-average conditions there. Up into Alaska, it favors that continuation. That cold signal is oftentimes seen into at least the southern half of Alaska. There's a weaker signal towards drier-than-average conditions. That's currently in our winter forecast as well. But really, the stronger signal for Alaska is cold.
La Nina is basically a phenomenon where cooler than normal sea surface temperatures cause changes to weather patterns. It's believed that the 2010-2011 La Nina contributed to extreme weather recorded across the globe. Halpert says that included record winter snowfalls, spring flooding, and a drought across much of the United States.
Some of the flooding that we saw in Australia and across the northern part of the U.S., some of the drought-stricken regions, the southern part of the U.S., Texas, into the eastern Africa. These are areas that have that particular signal associated with La Nina. So we would certainly say that, again, and that word contributing factor was one that we crafted here, because we've certainly seen La Ninas when we didn't see events as extreme as we saw this last one. So obviously there are other factors that interact with that.
Halpert says that La Ninas typically occur every 3 to 5 years, but about half the time, La Ninas occur in back-to-back years.
What's maybe become a little unusual is that some of the more prolonged events back in the early 70s and in the late 90s, we didn't see this kind of a break where the ocean temperatures would return to normal and then go cold again. We have seen that a few times actually since 2000, but it's certainly not unprecedented.
La Nina conditions typically last for about 9 to 12 months, but sometimes the event can persist for as long as 2 years. The name means the girl in Spanish, and its counterpart is El Niño, which features warmer than normal sea surface temperatures. It's anticipated that the re-emerging La Nina will influence NOAA's official winter outlook that will be released next month. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Mike Mason in Dillingham, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Tim Ellis in Delta. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.